in Boston.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Brazil held a first-round presidential election this weekend. The country's first choice to become president is one Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Lula, as he's known in Brazil, leads the country's left-wing Workers' Party. Now he's a lightning rod and leader for the deep economic discontent felt by millions of Brazilians. The population voted in favor of a new economic model for this country, he said, following Sunday's vote. And if he wins the runoff election later this month, the biggest loser could be the American recipe for globalization. This hour, On Point, Brazil, Lula, and globalization as we know it, on the brink. We begin tonight with a look at the man who all signs indicate will be Brazil's next president. As a child, Da Silva worked as a farmhand at his mother's side. As a teenager, poverty pushed him out of school and into 12-hour days at the factory. As a young man, he went to prison for organizing labor strikes. He's been one of Brazil's most prominent left-wing activists for decades, and his election has global financiers worried. Earlier, I spoke with Timothy Power, author of Democratic Brazil. I asked him why Brazilians are backing Da Silva for president now.
At the beginning of this year and late last year, people sort of viewed Lula as a Brazilian Harold Stassen, somebody who had run for president several times, had big name recognition, but could never break a glass ceiling of about 30% of support in the electorate. Mm-hmm. That was seemed to be his limit of growth. But this year, a number of factors have helped to propel him beyond that glass ceiling. One is fatigue with the incumbent administration of Cardoso, which has now been in power for 8 years. Mm-hmm. Brazilians are not used to two-term presidents. The Constitution was amended in 97 to allow a second term for Cardoso. So the moment is really fortuitous for political change.
We should know Cardoso is not running again, but it's his kind of hand-picked successor who Mr. Da Silva, or Lula, has just bested in the first round of presidential voting last weekend.
That's correct. In a certain way, the election is somewhat of a referendum on the past 8 years of Cardoso's government. Cardoso cannot succeed himself and nominated José Serra of his own party as the pro-government candidate. But the way the issues are breaking this year, and after 8 years of Cardoso, the opposition candidates did very well and picked up a total of more than 75% of the vote on Sunday's election.
Why? Cardoso, I know, is seen as having done fairly well on a number of economic fronts. What's in the air that's working against him and his party now?
Well, Cardoso's reputation outside Brazil is very solid. He's very respected by international policymakers, by markets and investors. He's done a great deal over the past 8 years to enhance Brazil's reputation abroad. He's the senior statesman of Latin America, and when he retires in a couple months, there will be nobody in Latin America to replace him. But what a lot of people outside Brazil don't know is that his second term has been a very difficult term. His popularity declined in the very first month of his second term with a big devaluation in January of 1999. His popularity has never recovered from that.
Are they just tired of the man in his party, or is it something about economic performance that's driving that?
The issues on the economy are breaking the opposition's way this year. In polls, when Brazilians are asked to name what is the most pressing problem facing Brazil today, unemployment is far and away the number one answer, about 42%. The second place issue in these polls is crime and security with only 18%. So far and away, unemployment is the main campaign issue this year for average Brazilians, as well as real wages. The value of the minimum wage, which most Brazilians receive under two minimum wages, has been declining as well.
What are the issues that Mr. Da Silva, Lula, has run on? Why has he captured so much Brazilian support?
He's a party that has always identified itself with a progressive social agenda of job creation, of raising the minimum wage, of dealing with unemployment, and has had a lot of support in industrial labor unions in big cities for many years. So the fact that unemployment is timing itself for the 2002 election really has played into Lula's hands.
How does he talk about issues of globalization? Brazil has an enormous foreign debt, perhaps the central factor in Brazil's economy. How does Mr. Da Silva, Lula, talk about that? And are Brazilian voters aware that their economy is all tied up with financiers in New York and London and all around the world?
Right. That's a very good question, because the issues surrounding this election that are of interest to us outside Brazil, for example, the debt, currency stabilization, and the Free Trade Association of the Americas, FTAA, are not the same issues that are resonating with Brazil's voters. In other words, what we read in the international press and how we see the election from abroad is not how the vast majority of Brazilians see it. Brazilians tend to see it as a pocketbook election about unemployment and real wages. But getting back to the globalization issue, Lula comes from a left-wing party that has Marxist origins and still has Marxist sectors. So it's always been the party in Brazil most critical of neoliberal reform, market reform, and globalization. In this year's election, Lula has repackaged himself as somebody who is much more moderate. I think there's a lot of authenticity to that, but there's also some element of repackaging for the election. So he has made some inconsistent statements over the course of the past year, at one point suggesting that the Free Trade Association of the Americas is the economic annexation of Brazil by the United States, another point suggesting that Brazil's debt could be repudiated, but in each case, retreating from those statements and adopting a more conciliatory tone.
So if Brazilians don't really think of their economic troubles in terms of issues of globalization and international finance, why has Mr. Da Silva adopted this more moderate position?
He does not want to play into the hands of naysayers who say that the slide in Brazil's currency is due to his rise in the polls. And repeatedly has said that it is the job of the incumbent president, not the future president, to take care of things as they are. But the fact is that as Lula has risen in the polls, speculative attacks have occurred against Brazil.
Because foreign investors are concerned that his true stripes will emerge after he takes power and that he'll create a less hospitable environment for foreign investment.
Exactly. His rise in the polls is linked to the skittishness on the part of international investors. Throughout the year, these investors have kept an eye on the government candidate, José Serra, who has been stuck at about 20% for the whole year.
And coming right up, you mentioned earlier the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, which has been high on the Bush agenda. The meeting is early November, I think, where they're supposed to be talking about a free trade zone that would encompass the entire Western Hemisphere. But as you said, Lula has opposed this. Is he likely to spike George W. Bush's dream of a pan-hemispheric free trade zone?
Lula has certainly adopted a very cautious posture toward FTAA and is presumably a strong economic nationalist. But what a lot of people outside Brazil don't realize is that there's quite a bit of consensus among Brazilian elites, both policymakers and politicians, that the United States is going to have to make some trade concessions first before Brazil will go along with FTAA.
They want more sugar, Brazilian sugar in the U.S., more Brazilian orange juice concentrate, that kind of thing?
Well, the fact that the Bush administration slapped tariffs on Brazilian steel in the middle of the year was seen in a very negative light in Brazil. And it's not only Lula, it's also the government candidate Serra and the two other defeated opposition candidates who all adopt this same cautious tone about FTAA. So really, Brazil is somewhat of a united front on this, although Lula is obviously the leftmost of the candidates. And Brazilian foreign policy has traditionally been the preserve of professional diplomats. So regardless of who the next president is, Brazil will be dragging its feet on FTAA.
But at this point, we see Mr. Da Silva, Lula, in all likelihood, winning the presidential final election coming up at the end of this month. Are Brazilians looking forward to a new Brazil, a new era?
There's certainly going to be a lot of expectations among his supporters that he's going to change the social dimension of Brazil rather rapidly. He's done a lot this year to try to dampen those expectations because the fact is the external environment, the macroeconomic environment, are very unfavorable for any policy experimentation. Lula is really going to have to take where Cardoso left off, and he's going to have somewhat of an economic straitjacket. He's not going to be able to satisfy his supporters as rapidly as they think.
Timothy Power, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Timothy Power is professor of political science at Florida International University and author of Democratic Brazil. We're talking tonight about the election of Brazil's next president, the country's potential bankruptcy, and the implications for global financial markets and for globalization itself. Brazil recently received an emergency $30 billion loan from the IMF, the largest in IMF history, and already the country is at risk of defaulting on that loan. Brazil's likely next president calls his anticipated election a majestic victory for the left, for Brazilians who do not fear change. But what about the global financial system? If Brazil pushes back against globalization or fails at it, can an already fragile world economy take the punch? Should Brazil and other developing economies grin and bear globalization's tough medicine? Or should the global economic system itself be reformed? How? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight is Mark Weisbrot. He's co-director for the Center for Economic and Policy Research and co-author of The Scorecard on Globalization, 20 Years of Diminished Progress. Good evening and welcome, Mark Weisbrot.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us. Mark Weisbrot, here we've heard about the dynamic of Brazil's presidential election. We've been through the first round. Later this month, there'll be a second round, and everyone anticipates that Mr. Da Silva, or Lula as he's called so widely in Brazil, will win. What economic circumstances will this new leader be stepping into? What is Brazil facing right now?
Well, that's a good question because I think it's very much misunderstood in the press. And it's very important to get this one thing clear. and that is that the current crisis is not a result of the fact that Lula is probably going to be elected. The real cause of Brazil's economic problems are the policies of the current government. They have piled up a huge public debt over the last 8 years. It went from 29% of the economy to over 62%. This is big. You know, in our country, in the United States, the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration moved the debt from 26 to 51% of GDP, and that was the biggest debt pileup, peacetime at least, in our history. And it was considered unsustainable, and it was, and we were able to now bring it back down. But that's because we had the option of very low interest rates on our debt. And Brazil
does not have that option.
Probably. Well, I think they might, actually, but it will require a change in central bank policy there. And it will require the government, you know, doing that. And, of course, nobody's talking about that right now because the IMF doesn't support that kind of a program. They're giving this $30 billion loan mainly for the purpose of trying to lock in the next government to following the policies of the previous administration.
Mark Weiss, we want to connect the dots, if we can, tonight, between the vote of a voter in Rio or Sao Paulo and the winner of the Brazilian presidency and global economic policy here. Brazil is framed as much as any country in the world by enormous amounts of foreign capital and the restrictions that those have brought to it under the IMF and the entire global financial system. How much freedom does any leader of Brazil have for maneuver, given the amount of debt that's there and where Brazil stands in that system?
I think they will have freedom to do what they need to do. But a lot of it is going to depend on how much the United States intervenes, for example, how much pressure they put on the government of Brazil. You know, the United States government has opposed and intervened against really every progressive government that's been elected in Latin America since the CIA overthrew the government of Jacobo Arbenz back in 1954. You know, as a long string of this. So, you know, and they just try, you know, supported a failed coup against Venezuela on April 11th. So I think a lot will just depend on how much hostility they get from Washington. But, you know, this idea that globalization really constrains countries is grossly exaggerated. And it's exaggerated here in the United States, too. You know, earlier you were talking about how this might affect the United States if Brazil were to default on its debt. It's not going to affect the United States at all.
Well, I wonder. I read George Soros talking about how in the global financial system, capital is being pulled from the periphery to the center, and that flow needs to turn around and so that more capital flows into developing nations to permit them to step up. If that happens, can the United States maintain the kind of current account deficit it has now? Can we really have our same policies and push more capital out to what George Soros calls the periphery?
We're not going to maintain our current account deficit is unsustainable, and the dollar is already falling. And as it continues to fall, hopefully gradually, our trade deficit will be reduced and our current account deficit will be reduced, and it'll, you know, that problem will be resolved. So no, we can't continue to borrow $500 billion a year from the rest of the world. But getting back to the Brazilian economy, I think it's really important that people understand this, because in the next few weeks, all the discussion that people are going to be seeing is going to be, well, will Lula follow the rules? Will Lula do what everybody, the financial markets want? Mm-hmm. Will Lula continue the same policies of the previous administration? But it's exactly those policies, the sky-high interest rates. You know, 18% interest rate set by the central bank. That, you know, ours is 1.75% here by the Federal Reserve. You know, can you imagine what our economy would look like?
No national leader would like to come in office with that. Mark Weisbrot, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about a power shift in Brazil and its challenge to the global market system. Is Brazil's presidential election, in effect, a referendum on that system? And can a left-leaning Brazilian president keep his finger in the dike for the IMF? Will he want to? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a power shift in Brazil and its implications for the global market system, the global financial system. Is that system, is globalization working for the countries that need it most? And in the latest presidential elections in Brazil, are voters in Rio and Sao Paulo intentionally or not sending a message to Washington? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Mark Weisbrot. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and author of The Scorecard on Globalization. Mark Weisbrot, what about globalization in the political debate in Brazil? We heard earlier from Timothy Power that it hasn't been front and center in this presidential campaign. Do Brazilians see globalization as a clear and present issue in their political and economic lives?
Oh, I'm sure they do. You know, they had a referendum just recently on the free trade area of the Americas. And, of course, it was organized by the churches and the unions and the groups that generally oppose it. So it's not a representative vote at all. But it is interesting that 10 million people came out to vote, and 98%, of course, voted against it. But that's the big popular participation in something that's, you know, not even that close to the agenda right now.
Why would Brazilians oppose that free trade area that would include the United States and all of Latin America? Of course, it's promoted as a step that would open up markets for them and permit much greater headroom for economic growth.
Yes. Well, if you look at the economic research on this, and I'm talking about research by the World Bank and by economists that are very supportive of the free trade area of the Americas, and you actually look at the numbers, it's pretty easy to see that Brazil has more to lose than to gain from an agreement, at least the way it's currently proposed. Because even though they call it a free trade agreement, it's actually a highly protectionist agreement. One of the main purposes of it, which was one of the main purposes of the WTO and the NAFTA as well, is to extend U.S. patent and copyright laws outside of the United States. This is a form of, economists would call this a form of protectionism, because it's a monopoly and it's the opposite of free trade. And so you see, they could lose much, they would in fact lose much more from the payments and the losses due to enforcement of U.S. style patent and copyright laws. They had to fight even to preserve their AIDS treatment program, which is one of the most successful in the world. It saved hundreds of thousands of lives in Brazil. And they had to, the United States went to the WTO and filed a complaint and, finally dropped it last June under pressure.
On behalf of pharmaceutical makers.
On behalf of the pharmaceutical makers against the Brazilian Industrial Properties Act, which allowed them to manufacture and import cheap generic AIDS drugs. So you see, they have a lot to lose from an agreement like this, which would enforce U.S. Patent rights and the patent monopolies of U.S. Pharmaceutical companies. But they really don't have that much to gain increased access to U.S. markets.
That free trade agreement may be secondary when Mr. Da Silva, when Lula steps into office, as he is expected to do. We read again George Soros saying that Brazil is confronting an unambiguous case of market failure, that it's headed for bankruptcy, and that if it goes down, it's going to deal a terrible blow both to Brazil and the international financial system. We saw what happened in Argentina, what's still going on in Argentina. How close to default is Brazil? And if it should tip into default, what will the consequences be?
Well, first of all, Soros has been wrong a number of times on these things. Just a couple of months ago, he said that the voters had really no choice but to elect Serra, and that hasn't happened or come close to happening yet. I think the debt is close to default in the sense that if they were to continue with the policies of the past government, it's a totally unsustainable debt explosion.
But you said that before, but that debt is already there, whatever policies they follow.
Yes.
So aren't they boxed in? I mean, without a change in the international regime covering that debt, which they do not control, what do they do about it? How do they really change those policies?
Well, the public debt is mostly domestic, so they could, in principle, that is domestically owned, and so they could, in principle, lower their central bank interest rates and continue to do that until they brought down the debt.
But isn't that exactly an example of the kind of step that they cannot take? Because if they drop those rates, they won't have the international financial support, the international capital coming in that they need to support their overall foreign debt.
Well, the foreign debt is different. It's complicated because you can't really default on your foreign debt because it's not owed by the government. See, Argentina was different. Their national debt, their public debt was mainly in dollars.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true in Brazil. So the foreign debt is a different problem. Some companies might default on that, but you can't have the country overall. Brazil can't really default overall as a country on its foreign debt.
Is it incorrect, then, to say, in your view, that Brazil is close to bankruptcy?
Well, I think that's probably a misleading way of saying it. I think what you can say is that the present government has piled up a large and unsustainable, under current policies, debt burden. And it is a difficulty and it is a problem. And they do have a large foreign debt as well that they piled up. And so the policies are going to have to change, and it's also very possible that they'll have to restructure, that is partially default on some of that public debt because of what the previous government did. But again, you know, you have to distinguish between that and the way it's commonly being talked about, as though the whole crisis is just a result of the fact that Lula may be elected. It's kind of the best analogy is you look at our stock market, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
That's really crashed in the last year or two.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people think that that's because of the corporate and accounting scandals. But really, that was just the trigger that set off the decline. The real problem was that there was a bubble, that stock prices were so high that there was no way that any future profits could justify those prices, and it had to come down at some time. And this is what's really happened with Brazil's debt. They have piled up a very high debt that is not sustainable, and they've paid 16% real interest rates on it on the public debt for the last 8 years. And so something really has to give. And the fact that it's coming to a head now just because investors are looking at Lula's election doesn't mean that that's the cause of the problem at all.
Mark Weisbrot, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation now Peter Collins. He's Brazil correspondent for The Economist magazine. He joins us this evening from Sao Paulo. Good evening and welcome, Peter Collins.
Good evening.
Peter Collins, we're sort of sitting on the global border here, looking in at Brazil and the presidential election there, and at the same time looking out and considering the global financial system overall and the kind of interaction between the two. But take us into Brazil first, if you would. What's your sense of the mood, the thinking of Brazilians as they've come out to vote for more than any other candidate for Lula, for Mr. Da Silva here? What's been driving that vote?
Well, it's a very difficult thing to describe in a way because there's no huge tidal wave of support for change. For instance, Lula, Mr. Da Silva, is now standing for the fourth time as president.
Mm-hmm.
He failed the past three times because people felt he was too radical. He's moved to the center. He's made some quite important moves in this election towards the center, and now he's ahead of the race as we go into the second round. President Cardoso, despite 8 years of difficult reforms, isn't that unpopular. If you look at the Congress, the left-wing parties have made some progress, but the center-right parties of President Cardoso's coalition still have more seats in Congress. So it's a very complex picture, and the way I look at it, it's open to different interpretations, of course. The way I look at it is that people feel that there needs to be some change, but they're not quite sure what it is. They're prepared to look at a slight move to the left, maybe, but they're not necessarily ready for radical changes.
Peter Collins, you can hear the fear in Mark Weisbrot's voice that the sort of frightened anticipation of Lula taking office could actually turn into a self-fulfilling prophecy of doom for Brazil, that foreign financiers will cut and run. We read in the Times of London that his election would significantly increase the risks that lie ahead for Brazil and for the global economy. Has he been able to position himself as a newfound centrist sufficiently to defuse that kind of fear?
I think he's gone a long way, but he's now got, if he does win in the second round, a matter of weeks or maybe a month or two to show that he's gone all the way. The markets, as we'll see from the sharp fall in the currency, the sharp fall in Brazil's bonds, are still worried. They're obviously more worried than the average Brazilian voter who's put Mr. Da Silva in the front in the first round of voting. So, but there are things that he can do. He's got a short time to do it. The government, the Treasury of Brazil, has enough money to, and some loans from the IMF to keep going for a couple of months, even if things get a bit worse in the markets. During that time, he can demonstrate that he really has changed. He's not some crazy radical. He's going to run a responsible government. He's going to continue to fight inflation. He's going to seek an alliance in Congress that can achieve many of the economic and social reforms that are still waiting. If he does all the right things, if he picks some sensible people for his ministers, he's got a good chance. And as you were saying, there's a danger of a self-fulfilling prophecy that markets worrying about a default will drive the country in default, because most of Brazil's debt is either tied to short-term interest rates or to the level of the currency against the dollar. Mm-hmm. Now, therefore, if the dollar, if the real, the Brazilian currency, plunges and effective interest rates, the rates at which the government has to borrow, go up, then it becomes an impossible burden. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if the new president, if it is Lula, if it is Mr. Serra, comes in and says, I've got a good program here, I've got some good people to govern with me, I've reached a sensible accord in Congress to push through some necessary reforms, then the currency will recover, interest rates will come down, and the debt will actually come down as a proportion of the compared with the size of the economy. In other words, the debt will be on a downward trend if things go well. It'll be on an upward trend if things go badly. So the markets have to be persuaded by Lula, Mr. Da Silva, if he's elected, or indeed by Mr. Serra. Mm-hmm. He'll have to do some convincing as well.
And what about Brazilians, Peter Collins? Do they see a kind of ironic cast to this, that the most left-leaning candidate in years to be elected will come into an economy embroidered round by so much foreign debt that his margin for action, for distinguishing himself, may be limited? Does any leader in Brazil today have the freedom, whatever his electoral mandate, to really take a different course? You describe him as turning sharply toward this kind of moderate centrist course so that he doesn't pull the plug on all that international support.
He's clearly very constrained in his first year or two. If he does win, he's got to win the confidence of the markets and therefore get the debt on the downward trend. He's got to convince his Congress to follow him in voting important reforms in both the economic and the social area. There are lots of things that need to be done to make Brazil a more sustainable place, if you like. Therefore, in the first few years, he will have his hands tied. It's only after that, if he succeeds in doing all these things, that he will then be able to make changes. He's beginning to realize this. He's been talking about this in the run-up to the election, saying that, you know, I want people to realize that, you know, we won't make all these changes in a year or so. It'll take a long time. So he's preparing, if you like, his own supporters, his own voters, his own political base for the fact that it won't be easy. He won't work a miracle in the first year.
Peter Collins in Sao Paulo, Mark Weisbart in Washington. Please stand by. A lot of callers want to join our conversation. Let's invite them in. Ivna's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Ivna. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I have some comments about, not about the globalization, because I don't understand that much to be talking about, but mainly about Lula. I've been living here in the United States for the past 5 years, and I...
Are you Brazilian?
Uh-huh. I'm Brazilian, and I've been watching Lula's rising into being the next president of Brazil.
How do you feel about it?
And I believe it. I believe in him, and I believe that Lula represents a change. Lula is a people's voice, a Brazilian's, of being tired of having the same old politicians running the show. We know there's a group of politicians that still runs the show in Brazil, and I believe that that's the main problem. The problem with Brazil's economy, it's the whole system behind it.
Even when you look at this man, Lula, he's been a labor movement stalwart from the very beginning, leftist, no bones about it, heads the Workers' Party. When you see him coming into office, do you believe that he'll have the freedom, the leeway to really bring some substantial changes to Brazil?
Well, I think I believe in his work, and I've seen I'm 33 years old. I grew up seeing Lula building the Workers' Party and being part of it, and all the elections, the presidential elections that happened after the dictatorship fell that had Lula as a candidate. I voted for him because I believed that he always wanted to put the truth and the Brazilians' interest over everything. Brazil has been run by the same old people. It's the same old game. The power is still in the same hands.
We've got it,
and
Ina.
We've
got it, and I want to thank you for your call and turn it to Mark Weisbrot. Here you hear a vote for Mr. Da Silva, for Lula, from someone who's been voting for him just as long as she could, who says he stands up for truth and Brazilians' real interests. On the other hand, we have Peter Collins saying he's going to have to really play by the global book for at least 5 years or so before he has a chance to make a real policy difference. A hard spot for that politician to come into.
Yes, I think I don't really agree with Peter, and I think if you look at the arithmetic, and we have it on our website at cepr.net, and we went through the arithmetic of Brazil's debt, you can see that the debt that's already there is an explosive debt. And you can't just go along doing what the previous government did and avoid a default. Either you're going to have to renegotiate it, or you're going to have a serious change in central bank policy that is supported by, you know, the IMF and or international financial institutions, and then change the whole situation, which none of them are proposing. So what they're doing is they're really setting a trap for the new government. They're saying, you have to do what the previous government did, but those policies are completely unsustainable, and they're what's led to the government this crisis in the first place. And by the way, Brazil didn't get much out of it either, besides the mountain of debt. The economy has grown slowly over the last 8 years, about 1.3% per capita per person, which is not very good. And if you take the economy, you look at the longer period, since 1980, the economy has hardly any growth in income per person at all. Now, Brazil was once one of the fastest growing countries in the world. From 1960 to 1980, it grew by 141%.
And you've got to wonder why that would slow down in this system. We've got to take a short break. Mark Weisbrot, we'll be right back. We're talking about a power shift in Brazil and its implications for the global financial system. Are voters in Rio and Sao Paulo intentionally or not sending a message to Washington? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a power shift in Brazil and its implications for the global financial system, and asking, are voters in Rio and Sao Paulo intentionally or not sending a message to Washington? Is the global market system, globalization, working for the countries that need it most? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Mark Weisbrot, he's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Peter Collins, joining us from Sao Paulo, Brazil, Brazil correspondent for The Economist magazine. Peter Collins, if I could, and I know I have to let you go in just a moment, but I wanted to put this question to you. Mark Weisbrot was saying just before the break that the IMF and the global financial system have effectively created a trap for the next president of Brazil, very likely to be Workers' Party candidate Mr. Da Silva, Lula. Given his background, his left-leaning background, his background in workers' parties, given the kind of language that he's said celebrating his lead position in the first round voting over the weekend, he said the 76% of the population voted in favor of a new economic model for this country. He said this was a majestic victory for the left. If this leader is feels trapped, do you feel confident that he'll stay with the program, or might his instincts lead him to say, the hell with this, we've got to find another way?
I think he will start by trying to make things work, and I don't think it's a trap. I think it's just economic reality.
Mm-hmm.
Brazil has a lot of debt. It's built it up over a lot of years,
mm-hmm.
Over lots of governments. A lot of the rise in Brazilian debt has been because Brazil's debt recently has been because the present government has owned up to debt that was there but not admitted on the country's books, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he will. I think he has moved. He has changed, and I think he will try to avoid a default. He will try his best to sort out the country's finances and then make his changes to economic policy as and when he can. If things get absolutely impossible, no doubt he will be forced to think again, and he might indeed say, well, we can't go on like this. But I do feel that he will make an effort to not create a default, a rupture with the system and so on, because he knows that the consequences would be very grave, and as ever, the poorest people in the country would be those who'd suffer most.
Is there really any path other than following the course laid down by the IMF?
Well, it's not. The point is, the IMF is not just doing this for fun. What we're talking about here is a program to sort out Brazil's historically very shaky finances that have caused this problem in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a very long program. It's taken many years. There's many aspects to it. It's getting everything from small municipalities to sort out their finances and to be more transparent about how they spend their money, to getting huge state firms like Petrobras, the oil giant, to become more professionally run and less politicized. It's an enormous program. It's something that Brazil needed to do even if the IMF and other organizations didn't exist. And therefore, it is a sensible thing to continue along that course. And I think Lula will, if he wins, try his best to live within economic reality, but of course, as time goes on, as he gets more capacity to make changes, he will indeed make changes. He will be more willing, for instance, for the government to intervene in economic matters than the present government. He will be different.
Peter Collins, joining us from Sao Paulo tonight, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Peter Collins is Brazil correspondent for The Economist magazine. You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Ricardo's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Ricardo. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Good evening.
I just wanted to add my 2 cents here. And we cannot forget that people voting for Lula are actually not looking into globalization or international politics, but into getting a job tomorrow and feeding their kids and sending them to school. And I think that to get that, we need a big change. And that's probably why they're voting for him.
Ricardo, do you have a Brazilian tie yourself?
I am Brazilian.
And are you surprised that he performed so well in the first round of elections over the weekend, or did you expect it?
There was a big surprise for everybody, but the way things are going and, you know, unemployment rates growing, violence rates growing, even me that never supported him, I'm actually looking into a big change. The way the government is being run by now, we have no ethics, and without changing it, I don't think we're going to be able to fix it.
Ricardo, thanks so much for your call. Mark Weisbart, we hear in this call, again, the sense that Brazil's problems are internal, that it's not global financial markets, but it's the government that they've had or the situation that they face at home. Does that suggest what does that tell you, that globalization is not so easy to see even when it's at work, the global financial markets, or that in fact you know, as Peter Collins was saying, the effect of IMF discipline has been to make people look at cleaning house at home? And here Ricardo's saying again, let's look at home.
Well, let's get a couple of things straight here. First of all, I mean, all countries' problems are a combination of domestic and international influences.
Mm-hmm.
But look at Brazil. Brazil's problems, the statistics I just gave you, about 20 years, more than 20 years of economic stagnation and versus its previous past of very high growth. This is the story of Latin America. You know, the whole region has hardly grown at all over the past 20 years. And it grew substantially, about 75% income per person grew, again, from 1960 to 1980. So it's one thing to have a cyclical downturn, you know, like we just had a recession in the United States, and we've had worse recessions for a year or a year and a half. But this is a 20-year period where a whole set of economic policies have very clearly failed. Now, you can have a debate, and there should be a debate, about which ones have failed and what needs to be changed. But that's what I think you're seeing not only in Brazil, but in Argentina, in Venezuela, in Bolivia. Across the continent, you're going to see more and more demands for change because this is a massive economic failure. And it's really only because, you know, our economists and, you know, so many of our officials are tied up in it, in the World Bank and the IMF and the U.S. Treasury Department, that we don't hear more about this point of view. But this is the reality for Latin America, and it's almost unprecedented in modern economic history.
Mark Westrup, please stand by. I want to get another call in here. Steve's calling from Washington, Wisconsin. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'm just talking about the IMF and World Bank, which is primarily dominated by the U.S., and through globalization, the economic growth has stagnated, like Mark is saying, the past 20 years. Before that, when they were relatively socialist, state-run businesses, the economic growth was much higher, and IMF and World Bank are imposing things that will reduce food for people, health care, education, and this affects people. People starve, we have more crime, it affects the populace. And countries like Botswana that haven't embraced in Africa these IMF poverty reduction strategies, as they call them now, have had higher economic growth.
But Steve,
a lot of these deaths have been because of dictatorships and the SUV driving public. Uh-huh. They have received most of the economic benefits, not the populace.
Well, 90% I hear you, but we heard our economist reporter, Peter Collins, earlier saying that in many ways what the IMF is asking for is simply the discipline to clean up debt problems that predated a lot of that borrowing. What about that? Could this be good medicine, too?
Well, it could in a certain respect, but a lot of this has been created in the last 20 years and it have enriched the top echelon of the population, the top 1%. Do the 90% bottom, do they matter in these situations, especially when their health care and food and education are getting cut way back and you've got rioting in the streets? The IMF riots in Bolivia where 8 people got shot in the streets, they knew about this prior to imposing these standards. And I wish Mark Weisbrot could talk about that, about Greg Palast efforts through The Guardian to expose this. The IMF.
We'll talk about it, Steve. Our time is running down, but thanks for your call. Mike Weisbrot, how about it? Here's the view again that it's the IMF that's making poverty, but surely that's not what they set out to do. Have they just got the formula wrong?
Yeah, I think they've got the formula wrong. You know, Joe Stiglitz has a way of describing it. It's kind of funny. He's he teaches economics as well as having won the Nobel Prize, and sometimes his students catch him making what we call a sign mistake on the blackboard. He put a plus instead of a minus. And one of the ways he described it was the IMF made a sign mistake back in the 1950s and hasn't corrected it yet. They keep telling these countries to cut their budgets and cut spending in the middle of a recession, something that we would never do here in the United States, right? We just came out of a recession, and our government budget went from a 2% of GDP surplus to a 1.5% deficit.
Mark Weisbrot, we've just got 20 seconds. Are you fundamentally optimistic then if Lula's coming into office or not?
Yes, I think he can. If he sticks to the program that the Workers' Party put forward, he can really turn the country around. It's going to be hard, but the question is not, as Mr. Collins suggested, how much he can choose the right finance minister that pleases the financial markets, but whether he can really implement new policies and turn the country in a different direction.
Mark Weisbrot, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Mark Weisbrot is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, a renowned author and activist remembers World War II. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Hans Koning co-founded a peace movement, was a reporter at large for the New Yorker magazine, and before it all was a 16-year-old in Amsterdam when Nazi Germany invaded during the Second World War. In this radio diary, he tells of his flight to freedom and how he fought the war.
Well, I was in Amsterdam. I was in the last year of high school, or the second last year, and the Germans, my mother came into my bedroom one morning at 6 o'clock and said, we are at war with Germany, and I had heard the planes go off all that night, very much more than normal. And I got the shakes, and I remember that. I was sort of trembling for about half an hour as a kid by myself. And then it stopped, and then I can truly say I've never been scared during that war, not in that way. I went outside and saw that the citizens of Amsterdam are already standing in line at the shoemakers and the grocery stores. Somehow, although Holland had been at peace for 300 years, they knew that that's what counts in a war. You have to make sure that you get shoes and that you can store some cans of food. And then a couple of days later, the oil reservoirs in Amsterdam were set alight, not by the Germans, but by our own troops. Thereafter, life became not normal, but became a completely different life under the German occupation. And we started to work on getting away. The Dutch Queen, the whole government, had fled to England, and they started to raise a new army in England. And first of all, of people who were already living in England. But after Pearl Harbor, which Holland was very proud that the Queen immediately declared war on Japan, even before Roosevelt, I think, this became organized. It became an underground line, the way slaves had here in the Civil War to flee to Canada, that kind of thing, was set up. So one day I met a friend of mine, said that he knew what to do, and he sent me to The Hague from Amsterdam. I just bicycled there. Then I bicycled to the border to another address, a smuggler. He took me across the border. The price I had to pay for that was to leave him a bicycle, and he put me on the train to Brussels. And from Brussels, we went on the sly into France. And from there on, eventually, we all ended up in England. Nobody got caught or killed. And it was a very exciting time. Although it sounds now rather horrible. But it was not horrible, perhaps because I was so young. And we worked in a chateau in France, on the French underground. And my task was to handle the pigeons, the carrier pigeons. And then after a few weeks, we got a signal that we could move on. And so we were smuggled across the border again. There were passeurs, people who made a profession out of doing it, some for the glory of France and others wanted to be paid. But either way, they knew how what to do, and they felt great contempt for the Germans. They knew exactly how to cross the border without getting into a German patrol. So I ended up in England and came into the Dutch army, which was a bit of a mess. The Dutch were not very militarily organized or minded even. The officers were all in London trying to find nylons for their girlfriends, and we were sitting in barracks. So one day a sergeant of the British Army, a commando, showed up and said, "Is there anybody here who can speak English?" And I could, just as I do now, because in Holland, on some schools you learn all these languages, nobody speaks Dutch. So I lifted my hand up, and a week later I was a commando to be.
Hans Koning's latest novel, Zeeland, has just been published. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University.